Mr. Chair.
Oh, there you are. Well, members, we have a few things we're going to do today, but most importantly, we have a birthday. Senator Peterson.
Yeah. Who's just saying to him down in his office?
Did you already? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we don't have to again.
Mr. Chairman?
Time flies fast around here, Peterson.
We were just honoring a birthday, Senator.
I know.
Did you want to do that?
Well, I don't know if Senator Peterson is aware of the custom in the Senate.
I think you should remind him.
He's taking us all to dinner tonight.
Nice.
Fantastic.
Yeah, Senator Cohen might prefer a St. Paul location.
You're paid. We'll drive up there.
Members, we have a few more folks who wanted to join us and testify on the bill. We have some amendments that have been prepared. I'm sure there are more amendments that are in the offing. So I want to, keep the front half of this meeting this morning to the public testimony. And then the deeper we get into that, the more we'll be able to allow for conversations between members and also on amendments. So at this point, let me ask Mr. Sertich, Tony Sertich, to join us regarding the IRRB. Good morning, Mr. Sertich.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
I understand you might have some reservations with this, a provision in this bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Mr. Chair, in order to provide you with inaccurate information and the premier recommendation and then its impact on our budget, I just have a question looking at the spreadsheet. The cut, the target in the Jobs and Economic Development Committee, who would know that number?
Well, Mr. Sertich, you are asking us a spreadsheet question, and the author of our spreadsheet is not with us at this time, but he's coming, Mr. Jensen. I can tell you, in general, the target, as we talk about it here in the legislature, was roughly in the $60 million range. 65.
Okay. All right. And then the proposed cut to my agency was $45 million of that 60. Actually, I have a spreadsheet right in front of me here now. Would the number be 62.276?
That sounds like
Am I reading that correct?
That sounds like it's the ballpark, Mr. Sertich. So I guess I'd suggest you look at it this way. We have roughly a $5 billion deficit. So I understand you may have some reservations with that, and I want you to get that on the record. But so yes, what has been suggested in this budget is, and that impacts you directly, would be 0.9% of the state budget deficit. So we're looking for a little help with 0.9%, and you'll note also that the language of the bill talks about it as a loan. That may not give you a lot of comfort, but the sense that we've got a big hole to climb out of one step at a time. So that's a little more of the background on that provision. Mr. Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And so if my math is correct, roughly 3/4 of the jobs area cut impact will be impacted by our agency. Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to walk through three points that I want to make with you today on, I think, the nature of this cut and its impact to the agency that I'm honored to serve. And the first one is how disproportionate this cut is. Members, the IRRB, as I was before you about a month and a half ago, is a regional economic development agency. And the main reason we are a state agency is because, and I covered this before, our area of the state that this agency serves by law is a very small region of the state, but it encompasses parts of seven counties in northeastern Minnesota. And the taconite tax, which funds our agency, the production tax, is paid in lieu of property taxes instead of property taxes. And generally, in all of your communities, you pay your property taxes to your local county. But for streamlining and efficiency purposes, the production tax is collected by the state because it's distributed amongst these seven counties, to the counties, to the school districts, and the cities. And so that is the very reason that I stand before you. But disproportionate as far as for this committee, the jobs committee, to cut one area 73%. And then if I'm to extrapolate that out further, if you look at the population of the state of Minnesota, there's roughly 5.3 million Minnesotans, and the area that this agency covers is 180,000 Minnesotans. So you're talking about a 73% cut to only 3% of the state's population. Mr. Chair and members, I feel that's disproportionate. To my second point, I feel this is inappropriate as well. Once again, we are funded in lieu of property taxes. In essence, what you're asking just this region of the state to do is to contribute local business property tax dollars to balance the state budget. We are not asking any St. Cloud businesses, any St. Paul businesses, any Red Wing businesses, any Edina businesses, any businesses outside of northeastern Minnesota to divert their local property tax dollars to balance the state budget. And so for that very reason, I feel it's very inappropriate to ask that just of this region of the state of Minnesota. The fund in which you are cutting this money from is a trust fund. It was set up 35 years ago, and it was meant to collect resources and then invest these resources. The State Board of Investment invests them into stocks and bonds, and then we have some unobligated cash in there. And we use these resources to fund economic development projects, primarily with small businesses, but in some instances with larger projects like Mesabi Nugget and Minnesota Steel, Esser Steel. On a very limited basis, do we take money out of the corpus? And you're asking to take a third of the money out of the corpus. This will impact us not just with that cut of $45 million, but yearly we reinvest the interest from the unobligated cash in this trust fund to do other economic development projects. And generally that's run in the millions of dollars, and we've been able to help, on average over the past 5 years, about a dozen businesses a year grow their small businesses. If we're just to factor in this cut, where we generally were able to invest and partner in the millions of dollars helping businesses, the impact of this would be to probably only be able to help one business or 10% of what we generally do, and do only one business deal a year out of this project's budget. And so I see it being very inappropriate to take only one region's property tax dollars and divert them into funding this state budget deficit. We've been very shrewd with this money. It is trust fund, so it ebbs and flows with the stock and the market. This fund that you're taking a third of was as low as $60 million earlier this year, or earlier 2 years ago, and it has since built up with good investment. And so what I can also tell you is we don't know when a bill will be signed and when a potential cut would take place. We do not know at this time how much money will be in that fund. You could very well be taking more than a third of the fund if the stock market turns in the next few months. And third, and finally, Mr. Chair and members, I think this would very negatively impact our ability to help create jobs in northeastern Minnesota. This committee was up on the Iron Range earlier this year. You toured a taconite plant. And the production tax is collected. That is basically the only wealth, and it's only paid that one time. A business in Rochester, a business in Edina, a business in South St. Paul, when you collect property taxes, you can collect it year after year after year on the same business. The value with a production tax is only that one time. Once they take the minerals out of the ground and leave that big hole that you saw, the value is gone for good. We can't go back and retax that value because it's gone. It's a finite resource. It's a non-renewable resource. Therefore, once this money goes away from us, it is gone for good. And you're really, I think, sending a very negative message to those communities that are working regionally that have set up a trust fund for the past 35 years to take those resources all at once. This is an area of the state, after we saw the census figures, that saw large population losses, some of the largest losses in the state. And this would definitely impede our ability to help create jobs. And finally, Mr. Chair and members, when you were at this hearing up on streamlining bills, which was a great appropriate step that the legislature in conjunction with the governor took in helping new projects and new businesses grow in Minnesota, the one project that we talked quite a bit about in northeastern Minnesota was PolyMet. And so the streamlining bill hopefully will help PolyMet and other projects move forward. But what you're putting in jeopardy is what the IRRB can do to help PolyMet in this second step. We talked about this the last time I was before the committee, is the IRRB is looking to fund and help with a land exchange for PolyMet. Where we're getting that funding to do that is out of this DJJ Economic Development Trust Fund that you all are proposing a $45 million cut. The Senate is proposing a $60 million cut. For me, in balancing our state budget at our agency, having either a third or half of our trust fund put in question is going to put into question our ability to help fund PolyMet. So if you are concerned about having PolyMet move forward, I would hope that you would reconsider taking our trust fund from northeastern Minnesota and allowing us the opportunity to fund these economic development projects moving forward. So, Mr. Chair and members, just to wrap up, three-quarters of this jobs budget in the House, the cut coming from northeastern Minnesota, I believe, is disproportionate. I believe it's inappropriate to take one region of the state's local property tax dollars to balance a state budget, and taking a number at this magnitude will very negatively impact our ability to create jobs. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
So, Mr. Sertich, just so we're clear on the numbers, what, in your understanding, and maybe Mr. Jensen can help me answer this too, what is the current balance in this Doug Johnson Trust Fund?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the DJJ Economic Trust Fund, about two-thirds of the money is invested by the State Board of Investment does our investment, part in bonds, part in stocks. The rest is in unobligated cash. As of last Friday, and we can check it daily, but as of last Friday is the number I'm using today, it is $122.9 million. As I said, though, that fluctuates day-to-day based on the market. And as recently as less than 2 years ago, it was down around $60 million.
Okay. So, and so, Mr. Sertich, then, if this is, and I hear you, if this is disproportionate or inappropriate, what else would you suggest within the IRRB that we consider as we try to reach our targets, as we try to balance a budget? What would you offer to think about?
Mr. Chair and committee, because these aren't general fund dollars, because these aren't, in essence, state tax dollars, yes, they're in your budget book, but that is because they're collected by the state and instead of collected by the counties for efficiency and streamline purposes. I would argue unless you all are willing or on the table to put your local property taxes from your businesses on the table, it's inappropriate to ask for any of these dollars because they are, in essence, local property tax dollars.
Well,
Senator Thomasoni, I'm just waiting for
you. Well, Mr. Chairman, if you want to go on with this issue right now, or do you want to go to other testifiers, it's up to you, but I'm ready to get even madder than Commissioner Sertich is.
Would you prefer to be mad at 10:15 or 11:15?
It's up to you. I think since you're right in the committee, you go right ahead and make this as it is. But, Mr. Chairman, I actually have amendments if you would like me to offer them now, but that's up to you.
Senator Thomasoni, I appreciate that. I note that our Senate counsel literally just walked in the room and she has a big pile, so I think we should tilt more towards testimony right now.
Mr. Chairman, I'm willing to hold my comments until I'm ready to offer my amendments also so I can build a base for the amendments.
We'll do it that way. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Sertich, can you brought up the property tax question. And I would like, I might have missed part of your comments, but the taconite production tax that's paid in lieu of property taxes, does that fund the Doug Johnson Fund that we're looking at taking here?
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, it does. And the production tax is paid in lieu of property taxes. And you may have missed the beginning part, so I'll do the condensed version. Seven counties are in the taconite area, our region, and that's traditionally where mining has happened. And instead of seven individual counties collecting this tax and distributing it for efficiency and streamline purposes, the state collects the tax and then distributes it back to the counties, the cities, the school districts. Those all get paid first because that's generally what property taxes go to pay for. The final piece of money then comes to this, to my agency, in a formula, and that is what funds the DJJ Economic Protection Fund, this production tax that's paid in lieu of local business property taxes.
Senator Nelson.
Just a little follow-up then. How does the amount of taconite production aid that you receive compare to what you would receive if you were getting property taxes, commercial property taxes, on all that mining land? What's the ratio there of your money received compared to the property taxes, commercial property taxes that you're not receiving?
Mr. Chair and Senator, it varies from year to year. And this is a key point. There could be years where it could be more, but if they're not mining, if they're shut down as they were in 2009 for a significant chunk of the year, we could get $0. If a mine is shut down, they still have the property, we could get $0. And that's unlike any other business in Rochester. They have to pay their property taxes whether they're making money or not, whether they have a profit or not. The mines don't do that. And the other piece that's different and why this is unique is they're taking a non-renewable resource, a finite resource, out of the ground. In Rochester, IBM, for example, they're taxed year after year after year for their property. In a mine, for a production tax, you can only tax it that one time when they take this valuable non-renewable resource, this mineral, out of the ground, and then they leave a hole that we have to rehabilitate and reclimate and try to find jobs and economic opportunities later. It's a very finite resource. And so that is the difference between the two, and that's why it was decided many years ago to create a production tax to get the value for the state and for the people living in that region right when they're mining the minerals.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more follow-up on that. I would be interested in knowing what those values are. I know that I think 2006 was the last time that we needed to report all of the property taxes that were not being collected because of they were exempt. And I think that's something that would be good for us to know as legislators, you know, and what the taconite payments have been. I understand that it could be zero at some times, but on the other on other years, there could be much less taconite production paid than would be should they be paying property taxes. And the reason I'm asking this is it seems to me that those taconite dollars that you receive in lieu of property taxes should be calculated as part of your net tax capacity when we're figuring LGA. And so that's something that I have wondered about is that and LGA is not exactly a purview of this committee, but it is of the legislature. And so I've just tried to understand why it is that property taxes would be held down by not being paid by the commercial entities. And I understand that maybe we don't want them to pay property taxes because it might hurt the job prospects. I get that. But on the other hand, you're receiving the taconite production credit in lieu of those property taxes, and local government aid is based upon the need between property taxes and essential services, your net tax capacity. And it just seems to me that by not having those mines on the property tax rolls, you're artificially increasing your need for LGA. And I would like to, I guess I'd like your reasoning why the taconite production payments are not, should not be calculated as part of local government aid, since they're paid in lieu of property taxes.
And Mr. Search and Sarah Nelson, we've got all we can do today just
okay.
to stay on the jurisdiction of this committee. I'll let you do a little response because I can tell you're ready for that, but I would encourage Senator Nelson to continue that discussion
offline.
Within the tax committee as well, but Mr. Sertich.
And Mr. Chair and Senator, that actually is my exact. You made my exact point. This is the taconite taxes and all that is not the purview of the IRRRB. We get the payment after it goes through the whole formula. So you have to talk to the folks on the tax committee. You have to talk to the range legislators. I used to be a range legislator. I used to have a strong opinion on that, but it's no longer in my purview of the IRRRB. We only get funded after that formula is done, and we don't have anything to do with LGA, taconite taxes, or any of that. We just basically get the remainder of that portion to fund this agency. So I think it'd be inappropriate for me to have any public policy opinions in my role as commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Search. And I know you can conclude, and I know you're going to stay with us. It sounds like Mr. Tomasoni might want to bring you up later, but a concluding remark?
Concluding remark, Mr. Chair. I just appreciate the opportunity. I know at the front end you talked about this hypothetical loan repayment, and I just want to be on record.
It's in language. I don't consider it very hypothetical, Mr. Sertich.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, having been a legislator for a decade and watching some of the IOUs that are floating around still this building, I think we'd be well behind the over $1 billion IOU we owe school districts. And I do know, being a legislator for 10 years, we can't tie the hands of a future legislature, and this repayment would happen potentially after any of us in this room are still at the legislature. And that gives cold comfort, I think, to this commissioner that there would be others who I know you're a man of your word, Mr. Chair, but you might not be Mr. Chair in 2017, and that could be. And if you hope not, then that gives me even less comfort that this IOU would be paid. And I guess we would be probably paid behind the school children of the state and the billions of dollars that are owed them. So for that reason, and then also the very reason that the interest from this economic trust fund we use yearly to do economic development projects. And so while it says it's paid in interest, I don't know how we would calculate that interest based on the investments that we do in the stock fund and the bond fund with the State Board of Investments. And so I just wanted to get that on record as well.
Thank you, Mr. Sertich. Let me ask if Jennifer O'Rourke or Kevin McHenry are here. I saw them earlier. They wanted to speak to a different provision of the bill. Mr. McHenry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Ms. O'Rourke is out in the hallway, and I can maybe speak on behalf of both of us for now. Kevin McHenry, I'm from Metro Cities. We represent cities in the 7-county metro area here at the legislature and also at the Met Council. We just did. I just wanted to touch base on a few provisions that we are in support of. I realize it's a difficult task in putting a budget like this together, but one initiative in the bill that we do think can be helpful to local governments as well as DEED in attracting private business is the Minnesota Investment Fund. We appreciate not taking any money from that fund. Basically, it is a revolving fund that loans money to attract businesses to relocate in the Twin Cities and entire state, as well as for expansion. Usually, on average, for every $1 invested, it returns about $4 or $5 in private investment. And as you move forward, we hope to be part of the conversation when you're working with the House and also with the governor to make sure the language does stay the same and possibly entertain some more money in that fund. One thing I did want to address in there, just an example of a success story from the Minnesota Investment Fund, was a expansion of BioVest in Coon Rapids. It used a $250,000 grant from the Minnesota Investment Fund, as well as some flexibility in the TIF statute from last year's jobs bill. And that actually resulted in about a little over $1 billion in private investment. And that firm, BioVest, that is expanding, is actually working on the first vaccine for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So we think it's a program that's very important, and we'd like to see it continue.
Ms. O'Rourke, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jennifer O'Rourke, and I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We're the statewide association here at the Capitol. And I just want to echo what McHenry just explained before you right now. The redevelopment account, the Minnesota Investment Fund, and the contaminated cleanup have been really good programs, if you will, that cities have been applicants for over at the Department of Trade or Employment and Economic Development, the old DTED. One thing I wanted to point out on your spreadsheet that I think might actually be traveling in another committee, which would be Senator Gerlach's budget division, is just what will end up happening with the petroleum tank release cleanup monies. There was a bill out there that I think actually might be part of Senator Gerlach's bill that would extend that another 5 years, and I believe that's a fee that's actually at the wholesale level on gasoline that blinks on and off. And those monies go into the contaminated petroleum tank release cleanup, and that does a lot of good around the state in terms of cleanup of polluted lands. So we're encouraging the governor's language on that, which is to extend that another 5 years, whether that ends up happening in this committee or down the hall eventually. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Ms. O'Rourke.
Morning.
Mr. Jensen, just for for members to be clear as to what, I guess, where that is on the spreadsheet and what we're suggesting that this committee does with that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's on the first page of the spreadsheet. It's line 30. The governor was recommending extending that fee. The Senate proposal does not recommend extending that fee, so the $6.2 million would not be available to this committee in the second year.
And, Mr. Jensen, am I right? That's a tax that is currently set to sunset.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Ms. O'Rourke, any other comments? So you're shuttling back and forth between this committee and Commerce, and we will make sure we're in sync. I'll do what I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. If I could ask, I've got a number of names, and I'm not sure if you're all together, but if I could have you join us. Maureen Kenny, Mark Sakri, Antonio Jenkins, and Lee Helgen. I know he's with St. Paul. Please, if you could. And then I also have Ann Fisher, so I know I've asked for five people, and there's probably only three chairs. If you guys are either really thin, you can make it work, or we can kind of shuttle you in and out.
Tony, how you get this?
So, Ms. Kenny? Okay, I have you first, and I don't mean to suggest a priority here, but you signed up first, so if you could state your name, welcome to committee, and if I could ask all of you, for some of these programs, we have heard testimony over the last couple months. If you could just try to confine your testimony to what's in the budget bill in front of us, that is what we are going to act on today. I appreciate how sometimes people want to describe their program and all that it has done, but I would just ask that you be considerate to the list of folks that are still to come. So thank you for following that. Ms.
Sure.
Kenny.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Maureen Kenny. I'm joined today by our board president, Davis Lino Mills. I won't ask him to come up to the table. I'm the executive director of a unique nonprofit organization successfully reaching out to offer individuals and families support towards financial stability. This five-year-old nonprofit is in West Central Minnesota and is serving 1,000 people through an innovative model using technology to link people struggling in poverty with the very things they need to get ahead and get by. The technology is a telephone, and the nonprofit is Northern Connections in Perham, Minnesota. I just want to tell you briefly the territory we cover. We cover from Moorhead to Wadena, Alexandria to the White Earth Reservation. We are currently working with 550 individuals with three counselor coaches that are helping people in four goal areas: reemployment, job retention, career advancement, and asset accumulation. We are that link for individuals when they're coming off public cash assistance program to help them stay on a stable path towards financial stability. We're about jobs. Most of our customers are working, and we're helping them stay working by overcoming the barriers that are problematic in rural Minnesota. Many of them are transportation and child care. We offer extended hours so that we are available Monday through Saturday to help people get through these barriers and these hurdles. I'm purely here to say thank you for including us in the current legislation budget here today. We believe we're a very valuable program. We believe that we are serving a need in rural Minnesota unlike any other organization. We have been recognized as a model that could be considered for further expansion across rural Minnesota. So I'm here to say thank you and urge you to continue to support us.
Thank you, Ms. Kenny. Is it Mr. Sakri?
Sakri.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Mark Sakri from Boys and Girls Clubs of Central Minnesota out of St. Cloud. I'm here today as a representative of the Minnesota Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs. And on a personal note, I've recently completed my 22nd year on the Stearns County Board of Commissioners. And with that hat on, I can tell you state dollars put towards these programs have been put to extremely good use and have really leveraged a lot of other dollars. Thank you for the opportunity to share some concerns with you regarding the proposed movement of workforce development programs to a competitive grant program. As you know, the Minnesota Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs operates in 52 club sites around the state, and we serve over 57,000 youth each year. Since 2006, our evidence-based workforce development programs have successfully served more than 29,000 youth to help prepare them for the workforce. We have several concerns, and we'll note just four of them. The timeline outlined in the proposed language seems to be unrealistic. There's very little lead time for both deed and grant recipients to make plans for possible funding elimination. If the legislation were to become law today, that would leave barely 4 months to create a grant administration infrastructure and RFP process. Second, if one goal of this change is transparency, we have concerns whether this is really the best means to get to achieve that. Since the report from the legislative auditor, DEED has implemented a number of reporting changes and increased the deliverables which we report. We believe that these increased reporting measures provide a more thorough picture of the effectiveness of the programs we provide and the youth we serve. Secondly, every 2 years, we come before this legislature to justify the state's continued partnership with Boys and Girls Club. For 8 years now, the clubs have repeatedly been open and honest in our reporting, and this can be confirmed by DEED. Finally, while the bill does propose that the Job Skills Partnership report back to the legislature summary data on grant recipients, this is hardly the quarterly reporting formerly required by DEED, nor the in-depth scrutiny that grant recipients go through every 2 years. Our clubs still internally report quarterly to the Alliance. This proposal appears to be a shift away from legislative scrutiny and actually lead to less accountability and transparency. Our third point, the proposed pool for competition, while not fully defined, could be problematic. With so many deserving programs with greatly varied missions vying for a pot of money with vague goals, there seems to be many unanswered questions about how the dollars would be directed and for what defined purposes. Finally, the Boys and Girls Clubs are in the business of serving youth. We run nonprofit organizations that rely on few sources of stable funding to leverage other sources of less stable funding. Much like for-profit businesses, we rely on stable, marginally predictable funding to run our programs. While only 6% of our total budgets for all our clubs, this workforce development grant has been that stable source of funding for many of our clubs. This funding has been critical to leveraging private dollars. We really need your help on this. Chair, members, we recognize the difficult budget pressures that you face and your desire for increased accountability and transparency in results. We believe that your desired results could possibly be accomplished by transforming the standards and measures by which you currently evaluate these programs. And that would actually represent a better way to support Minnesota's priorities of job creation and training in the most effective way possible. Finally, I have with me Antonio Jenkins, a Boys and Girls Club alumni and now a staff member with the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Twin Cities. He's happy to answer any questions you may have about club programs and his experience with the workforce development programs. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for your time and your help.
Mr. Jenkins, thanks for coming today. Welcome to the committee. Do you have a comment or two?
Mr. Chair, members, not really.
Tell them what you told the House side.
Oh, okay. There's not many people in St. Paul who stand away from the microphone. But,
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
So read this one. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Antonio Jenkins, and I am 19 years old. I've lived in Minnesota my whole life. I haven't had the easiest childhood and upbringing, but the one and most constant positive influence in my life has been the Boys and Girls Club programs and staff. I participated in a couple of workforce training programs offered at my local club, such as Smart Moves, Stay Smart, and Job Ready. Programs like these are huge for teens around my neighborhood, because teens are constantly getting recruited into gangs and getting involved in other things that just aren't positive. Through the above-mentioned programs, I put together a cover letter, a resume, and learned essential interviewing strategies and gained confidence talking to future employees. As a result, I was offered a job at my local Target store. I have since left Target and pursued a career in what I feel is more of my passion, which is working with young people. I feel obligated to give back in the way I saw others give to young people like me. I also, to this day, value the training I received and continue to receive. The workforce training programs taught me how to think, act, and carry myself as a professional. I have since learned the basics of being a good worker, role model, and a professional. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committees of the members of this committee. I now yield my time to the chair.
I don't think anyone's done that before. That's a new Thank one. You, Mr. Jenkins, and good luck with your future. I have Ms. Fisher and Mr. Helgen next on this list, so I think you guys are there, but maybe not quite at the microphone.
I'll go first. My name is Deb Barr-Helgen, director of the City of Minneapolis Employment and Training Program in place of Ann Fisher.
Okay. Could you repeat your name again for the record?
Deb Barr-Helgen.
Are you related to the other Helgen at the other
end? I am, yes, for full disclosure. Yes. So, thank you, members of the committee and Mr. Chair. Currently, the City of Minneapolis's direct allocation for Minneapolis youth programs through the Workforce Development Fund is $895,000. With this funding, we anticipate serving 650 youth. This year, we already have over 3,500 applications for our summer jobs programs. We strongly support maintaining a direct allocation to the City of Minneapolis for our summer jobs programs, and we have concerns about putting this into a competitive grant program. Inner city youth face multiple barriers that include concentrated poverty, chronic teen unemployment, and lack of educational and attainment. And these risk factors are met head-on with our very comprehensive approach to employment and training programs for youth, which offer meaningful work experience, skill building, the opportunity to earn a high school credit, work readiness training prior to their work experience, and wages that often benefits the entire youth's family, and a chance for a young person to earn the value of earning a paycheck. Direct appropriations offer a stable source of future programming, and this is very important. In addition, we have concerns about the creation of a competitive process for the Minnesota Youth Program and the Dislocated Worker Program, as suggested in the bill. The existing structure of a formula-based funding with private sector-led workforce board oversight works well to see that the funds are spent transparently, provides for consistent statewide workforce service delivery structure, and responds to the needs of businesses in all areas of our state. A competitive process would be unnecessary and administratively burdensome and very disruptive to client services. first just getting into a few details about the Minnesota Youth Program, and you'll hear more information about this in later testimony, but this funding source provides stable core employment and training services for all areas of the state and allows local areas to determine a strategy for serving the youth that meets the needs of their area. And then secondly, regarding the Dislocated Worker Program, this is core funding and essential across the state in order to assure that laid-off workers are able to access the training that they need so they are able to re-enter the labor market quickly. A competitive process would not guarantee appropriate geographic distribution of these services, and that's one of our main concerns of this bill. A competitive process puts core services in jeopardy. We also have very specific concerns regarding the proposed competitive process as it is laid out, concerning the effective date and the maximum amount allowable in a grant. So I'm being brief, but in closing, we thank the committee for their thoughtful consideration of these unique services and funding needs during a time when workforce development could not be more important to our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Barr-Helgen, and Mr. Helgen, you've already made a good move by allowing her to go first.
You know, I may not be the smartest guy, but I know when this right to defer to the people who know what's going on.
Mr. Helgen.
I am St. Paul City Council Member Lee Helgen, and I'm here to talk. I have four kind of key points and concerns with this bill. First, I want to highlight our strong support for maintaining a direct allocation for the St. Paul Summer Youth Program. With that funding, we'll provide direct jobs for 600 St. Paul youth. And this is critical given the huge disparity gap that you'll find in the core centers with the number of kids who are looking for work, actively seeking jobs, want to work, but aren't able to find those jobs. So right now we have over 1,500 applications in for our program. So this is providing that first paycheck job, which is essential, and really providing essential workplace skills. We think it's really critical, first, that we continue to get the direct allocation and the continuity of having base funding around that. We're concerned with a timeline that says July 1. As I said, we already have our applications in now. We're gearing our program to start right as soon as school gets done. Having something break it in the middle would have a real negative impact on our ability to deliver this program effectively and those families who count on that. My second concern, I also serve on the Ramsey County Workforce Investment Board, and I think what this competitive process is doing will have a very negative impact on the statewide infrastructure around employment and training services. So if you think of how the Dislocated Worker Program works to provide a base level of service for people who may lose their job throughout the entire state, making that competitive will put some areas at a disadvantage because of the overwhelming concentrations of employment centers and how we'd have to respond to that. So I think it would be really important to rethink what it means to maintain that statewide service delivery structure for a Dislocated Worker and Minnesota Youth Program. I also have strong concerns with the way you're using the Job Skills Partnership Board language. That was really set up as a way for economic development projects to connect with a higher education institution to provide specific job training. Here you're lumping in very divergent sets of programs with very different sets of goals and outcomes, very different populations, some of which may not even be authorized or allowable in the language. In particular, as a political subdivision, we would not be allowed to apply for this program, so it would effectively cut the city of St. Paul out. So that language definitely needs some attention on that. And then as we think about the focus that's supposed to be on jobs and economic development, as a city council member, we're also our Housing and Redevelopment Authority. And so we're deeply engaged working with our local businesses, trying to figure out how to help them grow, expand, bring jobs here. And a piece of that is having ability to connect with the education and training resources that are available. And I think this does not provide the sense of clarity that you would like to see in a policy direction going forward around how we connect with economic development, job creation, and really meeting that skills gap, which will become more and more evident as we see the aging of our society and deal with the kind of changing demographics of Minnesota, which are going to require very large investments around that skill gap and attainment gap. So again, we appreciate that you're thinking about how to make these programs work better, but I do hope that you'll spend some time thinking about the policy, engage those folks actively working in the field, and see if we can come up with some strategies that may allow these good programs to continue, but also meet the policy objectives that you're trying to achieve. Thank you very much for your time,
Chairman.
Today.
Senator Metzen.
I agree with all the witnesses of the last five that I think we're going way too fast on this competitive grants whole thing. I think the system has been working. It's been working well. I think that this committee and elected officials should be the judge and jury of the projects. We do them by merit. We look at them very thoroughly. And I don't think we should give this responsibility to the governor and the department head. Indeed. That's what we're here for, I think. So I agree with you guys. I've got an amendment a little later on to a couple amendments to try to fix this up and give the authority back to this elected body and not put it over with the governor indeed. So we'll fix that up a little later. I'll try anyway, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and thank you, Senator Metzen. And we'll have that discussion. But so I'm just asking my ranking member here, are you uncomfortable at all with this competitive bidding process, or is it the timing and the transition?
Mr. Chairman, it's kind of both. I think we're going way too fast. I don't know for sure how the details are going to be worked out. One amendment I have is to leave it alone for a year and then look at it the second year and get the kinks out of it and see if it'll work. So my one amendment would delay it for a year, and the other one would just do away with what we're trying to do here this morning. So I do have a compromise position in there. So
thank you, Senator. Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, as a member of the Minneapolis WIB for 10 years, I went on several summer youth tours to visit these kids.
Senator Kielash, is that an acronym?
Yes, the Workforce Investment Board at Minneapolis. Yep. So, and I think that's some of the testimony was how the Workforce Investment Boards deal with their communities. They're business-based, local elected officials and staffers that are looking to try to get the best bang for their buck out of the money that's allocated through mostly federal and state dollars. It's been a few years since I've been there, so I'm not exactly sure how it breaks down now. But in that process, there's within the summer youth program, they need time to say we have this much money, what projects are available? So the projects could be doing some park board work. It could be doing some evaluations of different things with the city. It could be summer youth daycare type situations or working with the summer youth. All of them have a component of education in them as well. So these kids are not just working, they're also maintaining that day per week where they are getting an education, and it's been shown that these kids do better in school as a result of it. And I can't tell you how many happy faces when the question came up from a 14-year-old, how do you like getting a paycheck? And these guys just beam. What are you going to do with it? You know, they have a goal. Each one has their goals with it. Could be a pair of tennis shoes. It could be. But having that summer first paycheck, and one of the things that, you know, I'm talking about several years ago, but one of the things that's going on in some of these neighborhoods is that these kids are living in environments where their neighbors, there's not a majority of them that get up and go to work every day. There's several, some of it's temporary employment, some of it's job specific, so it's short-term jobs. And the other model they have is the drug dealers and pimps and whatever else as an example. This gives them an idea what earning a paycheck is like. It's excellent. It's an excellent program that, and there's several just like it that are doing a fabulous job of, I think, helping reduce the crime rates in several areas of Minneapolis as well. And if you see the crime rates going down the last couple of years, I think this is, especially property crimes, this is a significant part of helping that along. So it's not just a jobs bill.
Mr. Chair, and I think the comments are great. I think the idea here is to try and take the politics out of it. You know, I mean, it's like the Renewable Development Fund. It's $19 million. I serve on the Energy Committee, and what we're trying to do is take the politics out of it, and I think setting up some sort of a structure where It's not a political thing. It's a merit-based issue, just the merits you spoke to. I think could provide better outcomes on what is funded. And I think you do have to look geographically and what helps the state as a whole. So I think the idea is to try and take the politics out of it. And not to say that the body doesn't make great decisions, but there's been decisions that haven't been the best. Not particularly with, I'm not speaking to here, I've got a little bit more, I'm talking a little bit more about the Renewable Development Fund decisions, that some of the decisions we've made there. So I think I don't want what's good of changing this to a merit-based system or setting something up to be lost in the conversation either.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
I've chaired this committee, and I don't view it that way as a political decisions we make here. I think we've looked at all of the proposals over the years. They're not Republican proposals or DFL proposals, and the chair knows that. We try to merit the best we can. So to keep using the word political, I'm not a little uncomfortable with that, because that's not what I've been doing, and I think the chair would agree with that as the chair of this committee. So okay. Let's not
I'll follow up on that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Howe, let me follow up on it. Yeah. Senator Metzen, I don't think Senator Howe is using political in that definition. No. He's
a pretty political guy, so he just...
when you're mayor...
When you're mayor, you're the old gray mayor.
Get through our list here.
I want to thank both of the Helgans for coming, and maybe this means you guys can have lunch together.
We appreciate the discussion. Thank you.
So,
thank
you. And members, so obviously the discussion at this table will continue, but I do want to get to a couple other matters. So I have Rosalind Wade. Are you with us? She's with the Department of Labor and Industry. And I also have Chris Iden down on that, so if you could join us at the table. And Ms., am I saying it right, Iden?
That's correct. I'm Chris Iden. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry, and with me is Rosalind Wade. She's the manager of the Labor Standards Division. And there's just one aspect of the Senate proposal that we'd like to address, and that pertains to the funding of the Labor Standards Division. Right now, the Labor Standards Division gets a direct appropriation for its apprenticeship program, for prevailing wage enforcement, as well as for LEAP grants. And the Senate proposal would transfer those funds to DEED for competitive bidding, monitored or administered by the Job Skills Partnership Board. The problem with that is, under the programs administered by the Job Skills Partnership Board, the Department of Labor and Industry is not an eligible grantee. Under the statutory language of the programs administered by the board, we could not obtain a grant for four of the five programs, and the one program that we might be able to fall within the definition of grantee, we don't meet the other requirements of the program. Specifically, we don't have educational institutions training participants in our programs. So the long and short of it is these three programs would be unfunded and would basically be abolished as a result of the proposal. And we don't think that's what you intended. We would suggest that the direct appropriation remain. Otherwise, these programs simply won't exist.
And Ms. Iden, just so I'm clear, you're talking about a direct appropriation that actually comes out of the Workforce Development Fund. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
For all three of these?
For all three of these programs. And the total of the three programs annually is $1,029,000.
And I understand we have some language that we're looking at. So is there anything else you want to share with the committee at this point, Ms. Iden or Ms. Wade?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we're kind of shifting gears, but I think that's the way we're going to best use our time. If I could ask Ms. Clark to join us again. She joined us at the very end of the hearing yesterday with a gentleman who was not going to be there. And if Mr. Moe, Paul Moe, and also Kim Peck will have all the deed folks up here. But I guess I want to first allow, because I committed to this, Ms. Clark to perhaps restate, because some of the members weren't here at the end of yesterday, and then if you want to talk a little more about the trade office specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen, do you want to interrupt this? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to ask, if I might, before Ms. Clark testifies, is we haven't had a chance to discuss the chair's position relative to the elimination. I don't know if it would help set the stage for Ms. Clark's testimony to understand a little bit more about what the thinking or reasoning was relative to the decision or the suggestion as put in the bill.
Does that mean you weren't here at the end of the meeting yesterday, Senator Cohen?
I was, but I heard the testimony but not the discussion from the chairman.
All right, so we'll have Ms. Clark go, and then if that inspires some more conversation around the table, I promise I will offer some comments as well. Ms. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Katie Clark, Executive Director of the Minnesota Trade Office. 95% of the world's population and 75% of consumers live outside of the United States. Companies that export are 20% more productive and 9% less likely to go bankrupt due to being able to better mitigate market fluctuations and extend their product life cycle. Companies that export pay employees 18% higher wages and 37% higher benefits and experience greater job growth than non-exporters. The Trade Office has a biennial general fund budget of $3,142,000 and does not receive any federal grant dollars. All the other expenses for the services that we provide are paid for by private dollars by the companies that register for the training sessions and consulting services to grow their businesses overseas. The 3.142 general fund is 77% payroll, and 23% is spent on space rental, utilities, computers, HR, out-state and in-state travel. And travel is just over 1% of our total budget. 9 of the 14 employees in the trade office are international trade representatives with specific international expertise, bilingual skills, and business relationships overseas. They are each responsible for a different international market, such as Canada and Mexico, Europe and Russia, Greater China, and provide training and export consulting to Minnesota companies on how to export their products to these specific markets that have different regulatory and cultural barriers to exporting in these regions. The majority of these employees have worked for the Trade Office for 15 or more years and have long-standing partnerships with Minnesota companies across the state and companies and business partners overseas, as well as public officials that open doors in hierarchical cultures. The majority of the international trade representatives have lived and worked overseas. They possess the skills needed to guide Minnesota companies to navigate overseas to increase their exports, increase sales, and increase jobs in Minnesota. Since 2000, Minnesota's manufactured good exports have grown from $10.3 billion to almost $19 billion in 2010. Manufactured good exports account for 55 to 60% of our total exports from Minnesota. And if you average the total export increase over the past 5 years and apply that to the next 5 years, we have the potential to double that over the next 5 years. Your current budget proposal calls to eliminate the trade office. I believe eliminating the trade office, we would be losing an important core function of state government, a tremendous skill set and expertise in the office, and we'd be hindering the state to truly grow jobs for small, mid, and large-sized companies across the state. And I want to give a few examples. Ideal Aerosmith out of East Grand Forks, Minnesota. They make precision guidance test systems, rotational rate tables. Their international sales volumes have increased by 83% since 2007, and they've experienced more than a 16% growth in employment in Minnesota and have sales to 17 countries worldwide. Leeds Forensic Systems out of Minneapolis makes comparison microscopes for firearms. 28% of total revenues is from international sales, and their sales volumes have increased by more than 350%. One additional, Recon Robotics out of Edina, Minnesota. Tactical micro-robot systems for use by military and law enforcement customers worldwide. Minnesota employment has more than doubled since 2007. They've entered 30 new countries in the past 3 years, and international sales volumes have increased by nearly 10 times 2,000 sales. And lastly, a company that you may not expect the Minnesota Trade Office to be assisting because of their in-house expertise, but 3M, based out of St. Paul. More than 63% of total revenues is from international sales. They're the 40th largest U.S. exporter by volume, $3.5 billion exported in 2009, with a global network of 68 subsidiaries and more than 180 sales locations. And one example of how we've assisted 3M, this was actually under Governor Pawlenty's leadership. When 3M's efforts to market a product in India were delayed by tariff misclassification, the Trade Office petitioned the government of India with a letter from Governor Pawlenty to reclassify the product, and that moved a clear barrier to 3M's success in India. And two, if I can give two more examples of how the Trade Office has assisted companies. As a part of our mission trip to Vietnam, Harmony, Minnesota-based Harmony Enterprises sold recycling equipment to Vietnamese bottling company, and the trip opened doors that led to additional sales to customers in Vietnam. And third, after making contacts on a trip to Thailand, Duluth area company Flatwater Fleet sold rehabilitation equipment valued at nearly $4 million, a significant international sale for a small firm. The Minnesota Trade Office organized the trip, facilitated the contacts, business contacts overseas, and provided sustained follow-up assistance leading up to the sale. I hope that this paints a picture of the work that the Minnesota Trade Office is doing for the state. I know many of you are familiar with our trade mission trips that provide valuable expertise to Minnesota companies, but our ongoing day-to-day export consulting and training programs that we do are truly providing a value to Minnesota companies and helping to grow jobs here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. I appreciate you mentioning a company in Edina.
I thought you would appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
And let me ask, I don't know if Mr. Moe wants to add anything on specifically on the trade office issue from a deputy position at the department, but I would certainly allow a little comment on that.
Only one. Mr. Chairman, Paul Moe, Deputy Commissioner for the department. Thank you for the opportunity. I think what I would add is that the fourth quarter of 2010, Minnesota companies set a record for the amount of exports, $4.6 billion. And I think the governor is interested in keeping this office and this function intact to make sure that Minnesota companies can compete in a global economy.
Thank you, Mr. Moe. And so, Senator Cohen, more in response to Senator Cohen, I guess, than Ms. Clark or Mr. Moe, but the discussions that I have heard would attribute a lot of this suggestion to the governor himself. That back in the fall in the campaign, he suggested he didn't need a trade office. That was kind of the language he was using, that he would eliminate it. I've had members express very strongly that they believe the governor needs to take the lead. He's the chief executive. He needs to be the lead on trade missions, on trade issues. And so the thought was, as is done in some other states, that this could be something that is run out of the governor's office, again, so that he would take the lead, that it's certainly a budget item that we have to account for $3 million here, but you know, the department helps, the office helps with trips, and that's important. There's some consulting, there's some training.
but that this is an area where we should explore some more public-private partnerships, and in an era of limited resources, is there a way we can promote trade? Is there a different way we can promote trade? So I think that's a little of the thinking behind it, Senator Cohen, if that helps give a little perspective.
Mr. Chairman, could I just respond
please
to that? Just a couple of comments. First, and certainly I'm aware that in some states, I'm not sure how many, I think Massachusetts, that the trade offices are run more directly within the governor's office. However, in the State Department's committee, there's no appropriation for that purpose. So if that's the intent of the state Senate, one bill ought to track the other in that regard, and that's not being done. Second, I want to be a little bit careful, because I certainly don't speak for the governor in this regard. I have no leave to speak for the governor. But I know during the campaign, he was concerned not with misadministration of the office, but with, depending on the governor, depending on the time, depending on the budget, I think what he viewed as possibly an ineffective utilization of the office. I think what he has intended with the placement of Ms. Clark there and is to try to correct some of the deficiencies he saw. And if the chair's position is that this is an appropriate concern of state government to try to keep pace with everybody else relative to international trade, at the very least, I would hope that the Senate position would represent a continuation of the office in one form or another. But that's not being done right now.
And Senator Cohen, I think you're accurate. I recall the word junket being used by, I think at that time, candidate Dayton, to refer to some earlier gubernatorial travels that might have involved at least the word trade, but some of these international trips. And they get probably more attention and publicity than maybe they always merit. But I think your points are well taken.
Mr. Chairman, I realize it's easy to look at campaign rhetoric. I don't know about yourself. It's possible you've never backed away from any rhetoric you ever used in a campaign. I know I certainly have on many occasions. So, if the intent of the chair is to recognize a role relative to this, I hope that the chair would work with Ms. Clark, whether it's relative to this office or if there's supposed to be another structure or whatever, but to maintain what I think. I realize it varies, and there might be junkets or whatever on occasion, but I think some of the efforts have paid off, and particularly I would note the testimony from yesterday. I assume it's fairly easy, although Ms. Clark made a reference to 3M, for the larger corporations in the state, a Cargill, a 3M, to have in-house folks who can do this as effectively as anybody within state government. I would think the fear would be for the smaller and mid-sized businesses who simply can't provide that kind of office, and those around the table who actually have worked in a corporate setting and have represented on a transactional basis corporate stuff, but don't presume to have worked in a corporate setting, could speak to that better than I could. But I assume for a smaller and mid-sized business, it becomes difficult to allow for this, even though there might be some significant opportunities.
Ms. Clark, you're anxious to respond to Senator Cohen, no doubt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Cohen. I just wanted to make a remark. With the 3.142 budget and that being 77% payroll, I do believe that the Minnesota Trade Office is currently being run on a public-private partnership where private companies are paying for all of our training programs, as well as the trade missions that we do overseas. So just wanted to clarify.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. And Mr. Moe, did you have maybe with Ms. Peck some more general comments about the budget items in front of you?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Yes, I do. Having going toward the end of the testimony, many of these topics have been covered before, so I won't kind of repeat what you've heard, but I'll mention those. We are disappointed that the proposal does not include some strategic investments, and I'll mention two or three of those and then kind of comment on the impact of that. For example, the Minnesota Investment Fund and the Redevelopment Fund, the governor had proposed some resources there. Those are existing programs that can deploy dollars right away. They create private jobs. They leverage private dollars. They enhance the tax base, revitalize communities with redevelopment dollars and so forth. And I think the intent was to get some job creation dollars in play right away, and these are existing programs with a track record that could do that. Similarly, we were disappointed there was no consideration for the vocational rehabilitation services match that we were trying to draw down the maximum federal dollars. And just briefly, the impact of that will mean that $18 million of federal funds will be returned at the end of 2012. Many service categories will be closed. There will be approximately 12,000 eligible persons placed on a waiting list for services. Purchase of services from community rehabilitation providers will drop off, leading to significant lost revenue of those providers and jeopardizing their ability to remain financially viable, in addition to over 100 staff positions within the department would be eliminated. These federal dollars won't necessarily be returned to the federal treasury. They will be placed on other states' opportunity for allocation to use them in other states. The final comment I would make as it relates to, if I can, on the competitive grant concept. You've heard some concerns. I think we share some of those concerns from the Dislocated Worker Program. I would add to that, currently the Dislocated Worker Program has a formula funding mechanism in place where service providers and WSAs, workforce service areas, get an allocation based on some demographics and some other parameters. We need to get some serious consideration about how that new structure would impact those current funding mechanisms. And finally, I would add, and Ms. Peck is here to comment further on this, is on the competitive grant concept, I understand that the extended employment would potentially also be included in that, and I think we have some concerns with that as well, and I'd like her to comment on that.
Ms. Peck.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kimberly Peck. I'm the Director of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, and my presence at the table today was really precipitated by communication between Amy Berger and Ms. Hauer from the Office of Legislative Auditor. Ms. Hauer knows our work in great detail, as you might imagine, given her role. And she felt that if I had the opportunity to speak to the committee about the processes that we have in place that might help to address some of the potential confusion and questions related to the competitive process. So I will do that, as well as speak to some of the concerns relevant to the extended employment program being incorporated in the competitive bid process. So first off, my comments are that the processes monitoring and the competitive bidding processes that we have in place at Vocational Rehabilitation Services essentially mirror what is described in the document that was distributed to the committee yesterday. So it's a process that works quite well for us. I'm going to highlight two programs. First, the Vocational Rehabilitation Program, which leverages both federal and state dollars. We do business providing employment, job skills training, and services to individuals with significant disabilities so they can be competitively employed and remain fully integrated in the community. How we provide those services is largely through purchase of services through a network of over 50 community rehabilitation providers. Those providers are required to be certified using the gold standard of certification for community rehabilitation providers. And then we actually have operating agreements in place with all of those providers. And in particular, with the purchase of placement services, those services to assist individuals with significant disabilities to compete for and secure competitive jobs, we have those. We purchase those services on a performance-based agreement process. For a successful employment outcome, as we define that, as an individual is hired and retained in a job for a minimum of 90 days, but a period where they actually are fully stabilized in the job, we pay a total of $3,800 to that provider. And those payments are made out in milestone payments based on the outcome. The first $1,000 is paid to a community provider when they sit down with the individual and develop a placement plan. The second milestone, $1,300, is paid to that provider when an individual is hired into a job and completes the first shift on that job. The final payment in those milestone payments, $1,500, is paid after that individual has retained the job for at least 90 days. So that describes really our methodology of leveraging and using state and federal funds in a way that ensures that we are getting the outcomes that are required both by federal and state investment of resources. The second example that I want to use, which I think is particularly germane to the issues that the committee is considering, has to do with the extended employment program. DEED has the authority through Minnesota statute 268A, as well as Minnesota rule, I think it is, let me see if I can remember it, 3300, to implement the extended employment program. And that program, what is remarkable about that program is it provides ongoing support for individuals with significant disabilities. And we have about 28 or 30 community providers who are certified providers in the extended employment program. We have certification processes in place where we certify providers on an annual basis. And in the Minnesota rule, it's clearly stipulated what the criteria are for that certification. Once we have providers that are certified, the funds that are leveraged based on the investment of the legislature, both general fund and workforce development fund, are distributed to the providers based on an outcome-based model. The goals or the results that are clearly stipulated in the statute and rule that we are looking for is hours of work that individuals with significant disabilities have served. And so what we pay the providers for are the number of hours by extended employment participants, the number of hours that those individuals have worked. And so each of the distribution of the funds in the extended employment program, it's roughly about $5 million, I think, per year in the general fund. It's about $6.3 million, I believe, in the workforce development fund. How we distribute those funds across the certified extended employment providers is based on their performance of the previous year. If they earn all of their contract based on the number of hours that the individuals in their program work, then their starting point for the next year's contract is that dollar amount. If they fall significantly below those targets, then those dollars are redistributed to other community providers. And if the amount of unearned dollars is significant, then we are obligated by the rule to distribute those additional or unearned resources in a competitive process. Again, that same process that's articulated in this document here that was distributed with the committee. So I do think that the processes that we have in place work quite well, particularly because in statute and in rule, the target population is explicitly identified. The methodology of the distribution of funds is clearly articulated. And we have the opportunity and the responsibility to provide annual monitoring of the performance of those providers. I had the opportunity last week to share the 27-page monitoring report of the Extended Employment Program with Representative Paymar, as we had a similar conversation about accountability of the funds, and I would be happy to share the same monitoring report with the committee. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Peck. I want to ask for one more group that I have that I know contacted our office, and then we'll have a little time between now and the beginning of session to start doing some amendments.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, just on
sure,
a point
Senator
that
Thomasone.
A point that Ms. Peck was making, I think, is that when you look at the spreadsheet, there's certain expectations by the groups that have certain amounts of money attached to their names, and Senator Metzen made the point earlier that the committee itself goes through a pretty good process of listening to testimony and determining how much money these groups should be getting from the legislature, and I think that that we do a pretty good job of it actually, and they tell us what they need, and we figure out what we can give them, and in addition to the fact that that they then come back and tell us what kind of results they got from the years before. This is not my phone, by the way. So, and so I think what Ms. Peck is saying is that that the process that's in place works pretty good, and that by putting another, we're actually putting a layer of bureaucracy into this, and maybe making it more difficult for the departments to actually give the money out. And so I think we should take that into consideration before we actually put this into play.
Mr. Chair. A question from Ms.
Senator Kielash.
Yeah, Ms. Peck, my understanding is all of these programs are going to be competitively bid in the future. One of the problems that I see with that, and that is planning ahead, anticipating the dollars. I don't know how many months are spent doling out these to the various agencies that are doing it, but I do know that it's not a short-term. You know, just what my experience in Minneapolis was, they started getting ready for the next summer youth program almost as soon as it was finished for that one. So could you just give us an idea of the timeline that it takes to plan for these programs, to review the proposals from the various agencies, also a bit on the grading system, and how people come get on and off of the funding sources here based on what the agencies are doing?
Mr. Chair, Senator, let me respond to your question. You know, I certainly do have concerns about the amount of time and effort on the front end that would be required to implement the competitive process. Typically, in our experience, for those programs where we use the competitive process, it really requires a number of months for us to walk through the process of developing the request for proposal, posting it in the state register, soliciting proposals, reviewing the proposals. It's not a short or a quick, rapid process by any stretch of the imagination. We do make a concerted effort to demonstrate due diligence in developing the rating criteria and elicit input from interested parties in establishing what measures would be most appropriate in the ranking criteria. Certainly the Department of Administration and the grants management area has provide some guidelines for that as well. With the extended employment program in particular, for those funds that pass through the workforce development account, there is significant question whether the grant-making authority that exists with the Job Skills Partnership Act, whether the extended employment program could even be routed through that or even compete for those dollars. So certainly if there was question about that, for the extended employment program to lose essentially 50% to 60% of its funding, it would essentially bring the whole program down. So I think, you know, as the adage goes, the devil's in the details. And so I think it will be immensely important to take time to consider what details would need to be in place to fully live into the recommendations that were articulated in the auditor's report. I am frankly concerned with the extended employment program. We do have the luxury of having roughly two positions assigned to do the monitoring of the activities. We do not have those positions in the Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program. So we would have to direct a significant number of staff away from direct client services into the administrative components of implementing the competitive process.
Thank you.
Thank you to the three of you. And then could I call up then Bob Kill, Phil Griffin, and I also have Ann Olson on here. I don't know if the three of you are together. So this is the Bio Business Alliance, and we have at least Mr. Griffin from the Bio Business Alliance.
Get them.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, I'm Ann Olson, and I'm with the Workforce Council Association, so I'd like to speak to the competitive process as well. So I don't know how that lines up with the other folks who are up here.
Do you want to be associated with these guys or not?
Can I get back to you on that, Mr. Chair?
I understand. Mr. Griffin and Mr. Kill, then we'll take you two first. And, of course, we're supportive and familiar with your program, so if you could try to confine it to the language in front of us and help us keep moving here. We appreciate it. So who should I look to first? Mr. Kill, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Kill. I'm the president of Enterprise Minnesota. Enterprise Minnesota is a standalone nonprofit that works with small and medium-sized manufacturers. And I ask that you strongly consider the continuation of the Growth Acceleration Program, the successful job creation program, that through that program, first funded by the legislature in 2007 with one-time funding of $750,000, and in 2009, despite the $4 million budget shortfall, $1 million more in new funding, again, one-time funding, was put into this investment. I think this is a testimony during that challenging time of the success the first 2 years since the inception of this program called Growth Acceleration, or GAP. 150 manufacturing enterprises have participated. As a member of a federal program called Manufacturing Extension Program, they receive an independent survey on a quarterly basis. It is a one-for-one match, so for every dollar that is there eligible for, they have to. We put in a dollar. Of the 91 companies in 2010 alone that took part in this program and were surveyed by this federal independent survey, they said, the CEOs, presidents, and owners, that they increased and retained sales by over $101 million. Saved their organizations almost $10 million, and created and retained 750 jobs. Since the inception of the program, over 3.5 years, that number of created and retained jobs during an economy that not many companies could say they even retained any jobs was in excess of 1,500. A vote for GAP also is an important component in leveraging federal dollars that come through this Manufacturing Extension Partnership, which is part of the Department of Commerce. I think we all know that manufacturing, we've heard it from previous witnesses talking about exporting, talking about other things, that manufacturing is key to economic recovery and job creation. And many of you have small and medium-sized manufacturing companies in your district. Might just mention, in this room alone, I can think of 9 of you that have companies that have benefited from the Growth Acceleration Program: Waite Park, Hibbing, Northfield, Egan, Duluth, Stillwater, McGregor, Winona, Red Wing. We are truly a statewide organization and the only statewide organization that provides business consulting services to manufacturers across the state. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Griffin, did you want to add something?
Mr. Chairman, I am here on behalf of the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota, and I would like to add something to the committee's deliberations. I have a letter from Dr. Cirillo, who is the chair of the board of the Biobusiness Alliance. I won't read the entire letter, but I do want to say that on behalf of the board of directors, Dr. Cirillo asked me to thank you for the role that you and the legislature have played in supporting BBAM to create jobs over the past 6 years. I won't read the entire letter, which gives you some of the details of the jobs that the Biobusiness Alliance has created and has worked in this. You've already heard that testimony previously, but let me be very clear about the point that the board is making today. Dr. Cirillo says, however, it is with regret that I am writing to you today to express our concern about the level of funding for the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota in the Senate Omnibus Jobs Bill. The Board of Directors made the decision that if state funding falls below $1.5 million for the 2012-2013 state biennium, BBAM will not have the resources to remain operationally viable. In order to be effective, any organization needs to have a critical mass of staff and resources, and BBAM is no different. As experienced business and organizational leaders, the Board of Directors understands this fundamental organizational dynamic. Close the organization for the following reasons. We cannot terminate
highly skilled employees, and hire them back at some point in the future. What makes BeamBam function so effectively is the quality of its staff and the years of experience they bring to the effort. If the people go away, it will take years to rebuild the organization. Number two, without a minimal level of state support, our ability to attract investment from other sources will also become extremely difficult, if not impossible. Please understand that this decision is a business decision based on the ability of the organization to provide services to its constituents across the state. Our board has decided to share this with you at this time out of respect for you and the committee. We don't want you to be surprised, and at the same time, we don't want to give the appearance that we are threatening in any way. We just want open and clear communication. We urge you to do whatever is possible in this difficult budget cycle to keep BBAM as a contributing organization to the economy of the state of Minnesota. The organization has set a positive direction that focuses on top-line growth. The success of this strategy was demonstrated by the numbers that we recently published in the five-year assessment report and gave to the committee. This trajectory will continue if the organization remains viable. The organization must grow, not cut, to the point of rendering it ineffective. Thank you for your past support and consideration of our request, Dr. Alex Cirillo.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Ms. Olson, I know this is a different perspective, but on the same topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ann Olson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association. As many of you are aware, we represent the dislocated worker and Minnesota youth program providers in the 49 workforce centers across the state, as well as the workforce boards that oversee the programs and the local elected officials who appoint those board members. After the earlier discussion and the good testimony by the Helgen team, my testimony will sound a little redundant, but as a statewide association, I just want to reiterate the concerns that both of them raised about the provision that would make the Workforce Development Fund programs competitive through the Job Skills Partnership Board. We certainly understand the intention of the committee and appreciate that you're trying to implement some of the recommendations by the OLA report in regard to the delivery of workforce programs in Minnesota. But as mentioned earlier, one of our first concerns is timing. A competitive grants process for a statewide program would not be feasible in the first year of the biennium. Summer employment is a rare opportunity to connect young people to their first paycheck. And in a budget year, it's always difficult for our programs to kind of get up and running after the legislature makes its decision about what the funding levels will be. But if a competitive process was put in place this year, it's unlikely that we'd be able to get up and running in the timeline that we normally are able to serve those kids and put them to work in the summer. Deputy Commissioner Moe mentioned that the Dislocated Worker Program and the Minnesota Youth Program funds are currently distributed across the state by a formula that takes into account the needs of the local communities. Senator Kielash pointed out that these funds are overseen by local workforce boards. Those boards are appointed by elected officials and are made up primarily of private industry members who understand the needs of the economy in their local communities. Essentially, the business people who are paying the workforce development fee are overseeing the dislocated worker programs in their communities and are supportive of the program as it currently exists, using those dollars for the specific purpose that they're intended for, which is retraining workers. We're really concerned that opening this fund to a competitive process might erode the employer enthusiasm for the funding mechanism that's in place for these programs. Finally, we're concerned about the $1 million cap that's in the language of the bill. We're unsure whether the intention that each of the 16 workforce service areas would have to compete and approach the Job Skills Partnership individually for funding, or if the intention was for the statewide program as a whole to remain intact, but the Minnesota Youth Program and the Dislocated Worker Program both currently receive more than the cap outlined annually in the bill. We understand that accountability is important. Both of these programs have measurable performance standards that are put in place by deed. The OLA report found that the Dislocated Worker Program is currently cost-effective. The statute mandates that workforce boards oversee the funds at the local area. So just wanted to raise those concerns, and we're happy to work with you with any amendments or other discussion that's put forward as this moves forward.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Members, I'll note we have a quorum present. What I'd like to do is start to have our conversations, and I know the paperwork is piling up behind us. Metzen's working overtime. Senator Metzen, to get off on a good foot here, I wanted to suggest that we take the angel tax revisions that you were carrying in legislation that we heard last week, and make sure that gets onto this budget bill. Do you have
that? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You and I have talked about this, and we think we heard this angel bill a couple weeks ago, and it's doing some tweaking, and I think it's all good stuff. There's nothing real earth-shaking in it, but it deals with the intern pay, which we talked about, and it deals with the private equity investment that we're raising it from $2 to $4 million. And the third issue is at least three whose investors is made in the certified business and who seek a tax credit allocation. What the heck ever that means, but it's good stuff. So I'm happy that, Mr. Chairman, you'd agreed that we could put this in the bill, so I'd move the amendment. It's simply a clarification of some of the angel investment language.
So Senator Metzen offers the A9, and to be clear, members, there is no fiscal impact of this. This is language. I think it's a good fit for this bill. I'd like to be on there, so... Senator Metzen's drafted this to add on to the delete everything, which will become Senate File 887. So all in favor of the A9, say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Amendment is adopted.
Chairman, if I might have another one that might pass the test.
On the angel tax?
This is on the medical gas systems that Mr. Carl Grimmins came to me, and he's talked to the department, and I think it's a clarification thing, so maybe he could give us a one-minute presentation, what it does.
Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Carl Grimmins. I'm with the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association, and we have some language here that refers to, it starts on page 22, subdivision 3. It's in regards to medical gas.
Hang on a second, Mr. Coons. I want to make sure people... So we're now talking about the A-10, Senator Metzen. Is that what you're wishing to offer?
Yeah, it's the A-10. Right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
All right, Mr. Crimmins.
Mr. Chairman, what's happened is we talked to the department and the board of plumbing, and there's a couple issues here, and it's mostly language. The American Society of Sanitary Engineering does not authorize certificates, so they wanted to delete the authorization word and insert meeting the requirements of. The American Society of Sanitary Engineers do draft requirements. They don't authorize. So it's mostly cleaning up the language. And it also includes the NFPA, National Fire Protection Association 99C, which regulates the installation of medical gas. And there's a practical part to the certification that's in a different document. So we wanted to make sure we had these language cleanup in here. As the Board of Plumbing is going through rulemaking now to issue a certification. And paragraph B was going to be deleted, and the new paragraph B was going to be that the requirements under subdivision 2 and 3 that a master or journeyman plumber or exempt individual must be certified by the commissioner, and the fee in subdivision 4 are not effective until 180 days after the board adopts rule. And that's pretty typical. When the plumbing board adopts rules, they have 6 months in order to inform all the individuals that will be affected by the new rule. And that's about the intent of the amendment.
And thank you, Senator, Mr. Crimmins. And Senator Metzen, this is supported by the department.
The department was aware of this, and I think John was in the room.
Yeah, he just gave me the thumbs up. So, and members, I just want to be clear. So this does not involve the valve issue that we had before us a week or two ago. I saw some of this language in the bill, and I had a little bit of a...
No, Mr. Chairman, this is a whole other issue.
So just to... members can rest assured.
And, Mr. Chairman, we also have that one of the Contractor Association representatives here.
Gary Thaden from the Minnesota.
Mr. Thaden, I don't think you need to go too long.
Or at
we
all.
We support the bill.
Senator Metzen moves the A-10. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. The A-10 is adopted. Thank you, Mr. Crimmins. Thank you, Mr. Thaden, for your blockbuster testimony.
If you got the order, you're damn
well. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I may as well start because I think the biggest part of this bill has to do with my district, and if the chair will allow me to, I'd like to respond to Senator Nelson's question to Commissioner Sertich earlier. And the reason that is because
Senator Thompson, let me just are you going to offer an amendment?
Yes, yes, I am.
Okay. Do you want to put something in front of the committee now while we're
I have to lay the groundwork and then I'll put it in front of the committee. Okay. If you allow me to, Mr.
Chairman.
It'll
be a little bit of a surprise,
okay.
Senator Nelson. Senator Thompson.
It might not be a surprise, I don't know. But to Senator Nelson's question, the mining companies don't pay property tax. They pay a production tax in lieu of property taxes. And as a result, they don't pay for they're not calculated in referendums either. So whenever there's any kind of public improvements of any type whatsoever, the mining companies don't pay. And to give you an example of what that means, it means that the Hibbing, the largest city north of Duluth in all of northern Minnesota, when they levy 1%, they can raise $39,000. And, Mr. Chairman, we always compare our places to Edina, so don't take this personally, but if Edina raises their levy by 1%, they can raise $1.5 million. And that's one of the things that happens as a result of the mining. But the other thing that you have to understand is that the IRRRB tax assistance area covers seven counties, as Representative Sertich, I want to call him that all the time now, Commissioner Sertich pointed out. But the mining takes place mostly in one county. Five of the six mines are in my district, which are all in St. Louis County, and four of the plants out of the six plants are in my district, which are in St. Louis County. And so the equity that's spread around is pretty substantial. And so there's a lot of reasons to do it. But going on to the bill, Mr. Chairman, you heard the word finite resource and what it means. And finite resource means that when the ore is gone, the tax is gone also. And if you go across the Iron Range, all across the Iron Range, you'll find mines that are full of water that no longer have mineable ore. And it's the legacy of mining. They mine on the Iron Range because that's where the ore is. And that sounds pretty logical. But the fact of the matter is that when the mining's done, the pits don't go away. The holes are still there. If you look at some of the cities on the Iron Range, you'll see that the city of Eveleth is surrounded by mines. They can't go anywhere. The city of Virginia is surrounded by mines. They can't go anywhere. The city of Chisholm, for example, had at one point in time 25 active mines around it. Today they have none, but the remnants are all there. At 11 o'clock every morning, my basement shakes on my house because Hibbing Tack blasts, and that happens all across the Iron Range all the time. The IRRRB was formed in 1941 by Republican Governor Harold Stassen, and he did it because he saw at some point in time the finite resource would be gone and that the industry that supported the area would no longer be there. And he said, we have to do something for this area in order to prepare for what eventually is going to happen. And that's what we're doing. And that's what this fund does. This fund is set up for a period of time in the future when mining doesn't exist anymore. But in the meantime, the fund is being used to create jobs and to create diversification of the economy while the mining industry is depleting the natural resource. And I have to tell you, Mr. Chairman, taking this money is outrageous. It's the rating of this fund makes Jesse James look like a dilettante. And when I see that 70% of your solution comes from a fund that has absolutely nothing to do with this committee, then it makes it even more ridiculous. I'm happy to see that you have a loan and you plan on paying it back, but as Commissioner Sertich so notably pointed out, one legislature can't bind another legislature, and I get a funny feeling when they see a $15 million bill going to the Iron Range that they may figure that that's something that doesn't have to be paid back, and that's for 3 years in a row. So, Mr. Chairman, on January 28th, this committee visited the Iron Range. You saw firsthand some of the problems that we have, and the reason you were there is to create jobs. The reason you were there is to see what can be done to create jobs. When you take $45 million out of the Doug Johnson Fund, you do nothing but eliminate jobs. It's exactly the wrong thing to do. It's actually hypocritical to have visited the area with the intention of creating jobs and then take the money away. And I am shocked that this is actually going on in this committee. I'm very, very disappointed. This is the jobs committee. This is an anti-jobs movement in the bill. It's targeted at one area of the state. It doesn't share the pain. And, Mr. Chairman, so I started thinking about that, and I said, well, if that's the case, if you really want to take money out of the Iron Range and out of our seed money that is set there for the future of the Iron Range and for our kids and our grandkids, then I said then we should share the pain. And so I've got something, the DJ0003 amendment, Mr. Chairman, that could be passed out right now. And let me explain it, what this does. This shares the pain. Now, what it does is instead of taking $45 million out of the Doug Johnson Fund, it only takes $9 million out of the Doug Johnson Fund. And then it takes $9 million out of four different Senate districts. I don't even know whose Senate districts they are, to tell you the truth, but they might be around this table. And what it does is it shares the pain. And I think, Mr. Chairman, that if you actually want to take money out of the Iron Range, then you should want to take money out of other Senate districts in order to share the pain also, because property taxes are property taxes, and they actually should not be used to be balancing the budget of the state. They've never been used in the past, and they shouldn't be used in the future. And they're for local uses, and they should be stay for local uses. But I honestly believe that this is a fair amendment in light of what you're trying to do in this committee. And I did it this way because this way, Mr. Chairman, it still balances the bill. And I know that in committee we don't have any obligation to balance the bill, but at least I balanced the bill here. So I'll move the amendment, Mr. Chairman, and ask for a roll call vote.
All right, Senator Tomasoni moves the DJ003 and asks for a roll call vote, so we'll be prepared to do that. So and you've identified four specific Senate districts. I know you're trying to prove a point, Senator Tomasoni, and I want to offer you the opportunity to do that. I don't know if they're in each of these four districts, if there are any funds that have $122 million as a balance right now.
Mr. Chairman,
let me just finish, and I'll let you go again, because I know you're going to get the last word in this one. So just to be clear, what the budget in front of us calls for is, yes, $45 million from the Doug Johnson Trust Fund, which currently, according to Mr. Surge, has a balance of $122.9. And we did a little math, so we're looking for 0.9% of a budget solution to involve this group, this agency. If you have other ways to do it, Senator Tomasoni, and I asked Mr. Sertich if he would offer anything else up, and he didn't. So we have to balance a budget. We have to reduce spending or find some balances to share in this pain and to crawl out of this $5 billion hole. So you know the task that we're about. We have drafted it up as a loan. You can take some or no comfort from that. But I think that's a recognition of this is not a preferred way to balance budgets in general. So I would oppose the 03. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, let me offer another perspective, just following up on your comments, because in support of the amendment, because your proposal really doesn't help balancing the budget in the context of our structural problem. One of the problems we've had over the last several years in this place is the continued utilization of one-time money. And this is one-time money. In fact, this is worse than one-time money because it calls for paying back the one-time money. So this particular cut, and Mr. Chairman, I have some, you know, a couple of disagreements with other cuts and certainly some significant disagreements with cuts elsewhere in the Senate. But this particular cut really doesn't help with the deficit in that context. This allows the trend of utilization of, again, one-time money, which does nothing for the structural balance of the budget. And that's why I was surprised to see this. And like I said, it's exacerbated because then
unlike using one-time money, which just covers current spending, and then shows up as the deficit in the next biennium, this is kind of a duplication because you got to pay it back. So it's one-time money on one-time money. So it really doesn't. It helps in the short term, but it really doesn't help in terms of the deficit. I was hoping, you know, before we came into session, before the election, that whichever party was going to be in the majority, that we would get away from this terrible, terrible practice of using one-time money.
And Senator Cohen, I would welcome any $45 million suggestions. Senator Tomasoni, to his credit, is offering one. Kind of. And just for the record, he's identified the Senate districts of Senator DeCrieff, Senator Nelson, Senator Lilly, and the chair.
And Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and Senator Tomasoni.
And I
did miss a few?
Peterson, try again.
Well, I probably could have grabbed a couple other ones, but I only needed $45 million, and I thought $9 million each was fair. But, you know, Mr. Chairman, it is a solution. But it is also an indication of what this committee is trying to do to the Iron Range. It's an indication of personally attacking an area of the state for a solution to a problem that is not the solution to the problem. And I don't know that any other district that I've identified here has a mine or has a finite resource that in the not-too-distant future won't exist and won't have any tax base for which to base their living on. And so if any one of your districts were to pay $9 million next year, they would still have that tax base the following year. We lose the mine. We lose the finite resource. We lose the mining. We lose the tax on the ore. We don't have it anymore. We don't have it anymore. And unless we save that Doug Johnson Fund for the future, and that's why it's a trust fund for the future to create jobs on the Iron Range, to create new businesses on the Iron Range when the mining's all gone. We have nothing. We have nothing. I mean, and that's the point, Mr. Chairman. And that's why I've done this, because you need to understand what I'm feeling right now. You need to understand what the people of the Iron Range are feeling right now.
Thank you, Senator Thomas. Cool. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Michelle?
No.
Senator Cohen?
Yes.
Senator Daley?
No.
Senator DeCrieff?
No.
Senator Howe?
What were those districts again?
No.
I thought about it. How?
Senator Lilly?
No.
Senator Metzen?
Yes.
Senator Miller?
No.
Senator Nelson?
No.
Senator Peterson?
No.
Senator Tomasoni?
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray?
Yes.
Okay. The motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chairman, then I have one more motion.
The numbers, just for the record, Senator Tomasoni, there were 5 yes and 8 no.
Mr. Chairman,
I
offered an amendment that actually gave you a balanced budget. I'm now going to offer you an amendment that does not balance it because it's not fair, and I want to delete.
Michelle votes no then. Go ahead, Senator Tomasoni.
I want to delete where subdivision 5 on page 5.
Hang on, Senator Tomasoni.
It's an oral amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, it's an oral. Okay.
It's an oral amendment.
It's an oral amendment. So.
It deletes subdivision 5 on page 5, article 1, section 3.
Could you repeat that one more time?
It's line 5.18, the entire section, subdivision 5, article 1, section 3 on page 5 of the bill.
That's just deleting that?
In other words, deleting the entire $45 million and not offering you a solution, Mr. Chairman, because I just offered one and that one didn't work.
So, members, I think it's the exact same conversation. So, Senator Tomasoni's intent is to remove that. So, we'll take that.
And I'll take a roll call vote on that also.
As an
Chairman.
Oral amendment, Senator Tomasoni's asked for a roll call. So, the oral amendment, just to be clear, is to delete subdivision 5, on page 5, which starts at 5.18 and goes through to page 6, 6.3. Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Michelle.
No.
Senator Cohen.
Yes.
Senator Daley.
No.
Senator DeCryf.
No.
Senator Howe.
No.
Senator Kielash.
Yes.
Senator Lilly.
No.
Senator Metzen.
Yes.
Senator Miller.
No.
Senator Nelson.
No.
Senator Peterson.
No.
Senator Tomasoni.
Yes.
And Senator Torres Wright.
Yes.
To 5, you think?
The amendment is not adopted. Again, there were 5 yes and 8 no. Members, we have session at noon. Another amendment or two that we can take right now. My intent would be, I think it'll be a short floor session, and we've got this room till 1. So I'll announce it on the floor if I need to, but let's just hustle right back down here after session. If there are some amendments, Senator Metzen, that have some potential bipartisanship to it, let's take advantage of the time on the floor as well. Senator Cohen.
I've got 2 quick amendments that you and I have discussed, which I think we can do quickly. Do you want to do those now or do you want to wait?
Does he agree?
Senator Metzen, I don't recall agreeing to anything, but I know Senator Cohen is working to the competitive grant issue, Senator Cohen. Well, let's at least get it out on the table and have you start describing what you're trying to do.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, you know, there have been some concerns expressed about the program, and I share some of those concerns, but I recognize that the program is a centerpiece of the bill. So recognizing that, I had a couple of amendments to try to just clarify a couple things. The A11 amendment allows political subdivisions to participate in the competition for the grants. It doesn't mandate political subdivisions, but it adds them to the other definition.
And Senator Cohen, you had a particular – this was kind of sparked by some of the city of St. Paul
the youth programs, St. Paul.
And the city of Minneapolis, too.
So I'd move the A11 amendment.
And Senator Cohen, I would think this fits, and so there may be some more conversation that people want to have, but I would consider this a friendly amendment. So Senator Cohen moves the A11. Further discussion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay. The A11 is adopted. Thank you, Senator Cohen. Sounds like you have one more.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the A2 amendment was language that Ms. Doyle drafted to address the other concern, which is what happens if other funds come into the agency from federal sources. How do we dovetail that with the grant program?
And Senator Cohen, I think Mr. Jensen played a role in this as well. So this was an effort to make sure if there are further federal actions or federal funds in this world, and you and I talked about that may not ever that may not happen for a while, but that so this language is intended to make it clear under this new structure how the state would take in and handle those federal funds.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. So we move the amendment.
Mr. Jensen, do you want to just – is there a quick way you can summarize? There is plenty of current law as to how we handle federal funds coming in. It happens all the time. This is designed specifically to the competitive grant structure.
Mr. Chairman, members, what we were attempting to do here is to have the Job Skills Partnership Board have the authority to do this processing of federal money. Right now it's kind of with the legislature, and this gives the Partnership Board the authority to handle this federal money.
And Senator Cohen, if I'm looking at the time, and I understand, I'd like to get Deed on the record on this because I understand they have some maintenance of effort concerns. So members, let's recess, and we will take up the A2 immediately after session. Committee is in recess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we get booted at one. So
did you finish?
Is there any reason to be here?
Ooh, I don't like this one here.
Okay.
Partnership will all the cases of better insurance. You know,
I'll tell you what I don't like about this. This is good job. Requiring that to meet the funding.
Oh, very good.
That's basically
a I'm going to put them down right now.
That's saying.
It works. I don't know how nice it was. You're pretty effective most of the time.
I think that's
same as you have.
No, we're going to have to say no on that piece.
This is the one they're talking about?
Yeah.
All right.
Done by noon, didn't it?
No.